Actually, if this sounds familiar, Mr. DeVilbiss called me today and asked me if I could cover for him. So I said, sure. I'm going to give you the one I gave you 2 weeks ago. I just changed the title, so act like it's new. And then we'll all be happy. But no. Today, I want to talk about, and actually the title of my sermon today is, The Love of Many Shall Grow Cold. You know, over the last few years, several years actually, there's been a lot of controversy about the display of the Ten Commandments in public places. Some groups obviously want them displayed, those of us who feel strongly about the Ten Commandments and what they stand for. And there's a lot of people out there who don't want them. You know, we have one of the proud things we have here in Wisconsin is the Freedom From Religion Foundation that doesn't want to have anything with religion. They won't have to see it, they don't want to hear it, and they don't want you to be able to see it or hear it as well. And there are people, again, they're very determined to ensure that they're not displayed anywhere. Back in 2003, the Ten Commandments Defense Act, sponsored by Congressman Robert Otterholt, passed overwhelmingly in the United States the U.S. House of Representatives. And it says this, the Ten Commandments Defense Act Amendment, it allows the authority of states under the Tenth Amendment to display the Ten Commandments in public places. This amendment also guarantees the freedom of religious expression under the First and the 14th Amendments to the Constitution. While speaking about this act, Representative Otterholt said this. He said, "The Ten Commandments represent the very cornerstone of Western civilization and the basis of our legal system here in America." Well, this was in 2003. To exclude the display of the Ten Commandments and suggest that it is in some way an establishment of religion is not consistent with our nation's heritage. This nation was founded on religious traditions, and they are an integral part of the fabric of American culture, political, and social life. He went on to say, "This amendment today is not just about the display of the Ten Commandments, it's also about the nation's children, or our nation's children, excuse me, and the role that values play in our national life." He said, and he in bold, he said this when he finished up, "Our nation was founded on Judeo-Christian principles and by our founding fathers, and that's what I want to see continue." And at the time, again, this is almost 10 years ago, this passed overwhelmingly in the House. This act has been brought back up again recently because they think it's a little strongly worded, that maybe we're pushing religion on people a little too much. Now, it would be interesting to see where this goes. But when this was passed, there were a lot of people who were very happy to see that, and there were a lot of people who were unhappy. They don't want to have to look at this stuff, this Ten Commandments stuff around. And there's another large group out there who don't even see the value of the Ten Commandments, whether they're good or bad. Since 2003, we've seen the federal government, though, force the removal of the Ten Commandments from the federal courthouse in Alabama, and I've heard of countless stories of attacking the Ten Commandments. And when we were still living in Toma and going to La Crosse Church, there were several parks there that they were after them, this Freedom From Religion group saying, "You will remove these plaques because it's offensive to us." And they worked around it mostly within the city. But here in our state of Wisconsin, you know, we are the hub of this Freedom From Religion Act, and it's everywhere that we look. The sentiment of those who are not pleased, I think, by the act and by the display of the Ten Commandments, I think is exemplified by a couple of quotes I came across recently in an article. And this was referring back to, these are some people that have brought up the act again saying it's a little strong, okay? And maybe it doesn't need to push a religion so much as on a federal level. But this is a lady, she's the director of legal services for the School Administrators of Iowa. And she said, "Displaying the Ten Commandments, it's not going to save the children from lunatics with guns or bombs, nor is it going to have the kind of moral effect that I think the members of the House think it does." She also said the legislation is somewhat like wearing a clove of garlic around one's neck in hopes of scaring off vampires. It's certainly not a trade-off for doing background checks on people who buy guns at gun shows. I know some of you people. Even the Reverend David Young of the Hope Lutheran Church said this. He said, displaying the Ten Commandments on a school wall, quote, seems like a token thing that won't do anything to solve any of the problems. You might as well not waste the paper, he said. And this is a pastor. We know how messed up the world is and how much Satan is pushing for anything that has anything to do with religion. He's pushing against it. And we understand even more so the importance of the Ten Commandments in God's law. We understand what their intention were, that God wants us to obey them because we are part of something bigger. Mr. Schmidt alluded to the Holy Day season coming up, and we understand what that Holy Day season, what that pictures in God's plan of salvation for us. But today, we understand, we see it all around us, God's laws are undergoing an increasing assault in society. You know, there are people that just plain don't want to be told to do. They want to be told how to live. They don't want to be restricted in their moral choices. We had a person, was it last week, week before last, actually testifying before Congress. You saw it about how we as taxpayers should be paying for her birth control. You know, you've heard about that. You've seen it. There's not even shame anymore. Satan is the ruler of this world. There's no question. And we can look around at many different aspects of society, from civil laws to the media to the schools. You know, the list goes on and on of entities that are increasingly moving away or growing away from God. As we approach Passover, which is less than a month away, all of us are in the process of preparing physically and emotionally and hopefully, even more importantly, spiritually for that night. You know, we're looking at ourselves, we're looking inward, we're examining ourselves to see what progress we've made in the last year. You know, among them, or I guess I want to say, the question I would ask is, how are we doing? How are you doing at coming out of this world? What progress have you made in the last year? What I want to do for the rest of the message this afternoon is give a few examples of the extent of lawlessness that is running rampant around us. And basically, hopefully as a reminder to all of us not to be affected by some of the same things that are decaying society. You see, we're supposed to be moving ahead in our relationship with God, not even just standing still, you know, or holding our own. We're supposed to be growing. God's law has been under assault ever since Adam and Eve first partook of the forbidden fruit. But if you consider that since that time, the severity of the assault seems to be increasing. And it seems as we get closer to the end time, to that time when Christ is going to return, it seems like Satan's turning up the heat. And more lawlessness is going on around us. And it's really easy to get sucked into that at times. Increasingly, we can see in every aspect of society, God's law being pushed aside even more. Turn back in Matthew 24, if you would, please. Our Bible tells us about this time. It's not a surprise. We know that things are getting bad. They're going to get worse before Christ returns. But Matthew 24, it tells us in the end times that lawlessness will abound. Start in verse 3. It says, now, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. And that's something that I pray for every day, because we look around us. Look, for those of you who have been around a long time, look how many people have been deceived and aren't with us anymore. And it could be one of us if we don't keep our guard up. But he says, and it's important enough that he says, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. I see a lot of earthquakes in various places, but the time isn't here yet. It's going to get worse. Verse 8, it says, all these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. And then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And verse 12, very important. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Verse 13, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. We want to be a part of that verse 13, those that endure. What's the chance that some of us in this room, that our love might grow cold? God tells us it's going to happen. We need to be sure that we don't allow that in our lives. The word lawlessness is used in a way which indicates the meaning as being lawlessness or wickedness. Its usual rendering in the New Testament is iniquity, which literally means unrighteousness. Iniquity in the Greek, or translate the Greek, iniquity, sorry, translates the Greek word anomia, A-N-O-M-I-A, which literally means lawlessness. So we've kind of come in a circle here. Lawlessness is a characteristic trait of the rebellious heart. Lawlessness does not result from a lack of law, but from rebellion to it. So it's not the fact that there isn't a law, it's the fact that I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it. You can't make me do it. You know, we see that, you know, Jesus said that in the times before he comes back, that rebellion to all law will abound. And don't you see that starting now? Don't we see it? And everywhere we look, has it affected us yet? You and I, as we approach this Passover season, have we gotten off track? Have we digressed? Have we allowed the world to draw us away in any possible fashion? You know, as we come back to the Ten Commandments, just the Ten Commandments, and I don't mean just because they're a very big deal, but the Ten Commandments mean virtually nothing to many, many people on this earth. For a smaller group of people, they're merely suggestions. And only for a tiny fraction of people are they truly commandments. And that I'm talking to some of those people right now. Let's explore further this afternoon a little bit further by a brief review of the commandments. I want to ask you, how have you grown in the last year as compared to these 10 commandments that we all understand, that aren't secret and aren't hidden? They're specifically what God has said, do this or don't do this. Let's turn it back to Exodus. We talked about in a speaker's meeting here a couple weeks ago that we thought that we thought it might be a good idea that some of the sermonette men maybe pick one of the Ten Commandments, and we give sermonettes on them. And I think that's a really good idea, that we focus on some of these. And so I don't want to take that away from anyone, because I want to be a part of that. But let's look at them just briefly, all 10 of them, and apply them to ourselves and look at some different areas. Let's start in verse 1 of Exodus 20. It says, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Commandment number 1, verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall have no other gods before me. Remember, there's this huge group of people on the earth that commandments mean nothing to. Let me give you an idea of some of that. Just in the United States, and this is from 2010, non-Christian religious adherents, so they have some kind of religion, just in the United States. And let me just give you an idea. In the mid-1990, we'll start with the atheist group first. In the mid-1990, there were 770,000 red atheists in the United States, according to this book. 2010, there were recorded 2.5 million atheists in the United States. Overall, religious adherence in 1900, we had 2,700,000 people who claimed to have a religion of some sort. In mid-2010, we had 81 million who claimed to have some kind of religious belief. As I look down here through the list, some of the people, let's look at some people that we hear a lot about. You know, we talked about atheists, Buddhists. In 1900, we had 30,000 Buddhists in the United States. Mid-2010, we have 3,500,000. The Baha'i religion, we had 2,800 in the mid-1900. Today, we have 1.25 million. Before, they used to be, I should mention that before, they used to be less than 0.1% of the population, both the Baha'i and the Buddhist. Today, they are a little over almost 2% of the religious adherents in the United States. What about Jews? In 1900, we had 1,500,000 Jews in the U.S. Mid-1990, we had 5.53 million. Mid-2010, we have 4.5 million. So they're actually declining. This makes me feel good. Muslims who really don't like people like us who don't believe what they do. There were 10,000 of them in 1900 living in the United States. Mid-1990, there were 3.6 million. Mid-2010, there are 12,950,000 Muslims living in the United States. And I could go on down through, you know, the Sikhs, the black Muslims, etc. But what we're seeing is that there are a huge amount of people who have other gods before the true God. And we could spend time talking about what we understand the depth of the first commandment, meaning not just worshiping an idol or whatever, but by putting anything first before God. Whether it be, I love to fish. I used to not have balance in my life. I used to fish all the time. It was an idol to me. I put fishing and playing around before God. The trap that is easy for us to fall into, it is a trap that's easy for us to fall into by putting something ahead of God or someone before God in our lives. And so we need to remember that. And we need to look at the last year. Where is our priority with God? Is He still our number one priority? How do we show it? How do we live it? What are we doing every day? Let's go on in Exodus, verse 4 of chapter 20. It says, "You shall not make for yourself any carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I am the Lord your God. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to their third and fourth generations of those who hate me." So, second commandment we understand is you shall have no graven images. You shall make for yourself no carved images. Look around you in the world. Look around you at things that people worship. If you watch National Geographic Channel, we got temples, we got crosses, we got Buddhas, we got statues, we have all of these things that people are bowing down to. And we understand that we're not supposed to do that. Going on in verse 6, it says, "But showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Verse 7, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." You probably don't hear much of that going on, unless you watch TV or read or movies or read books or radio or read the newspaper or play golf, or leave the house, or go for a walk, or have any interaction with the world. It's all around us. What about yourself? What about when you smash your finger? Or are cut off in traffic, or are treated rudely, or somebody broke something that you really liked, or whatever. How easy is it for us to do that? It can be, unfortunately, very easy, because old habits are hard to break. And it's even easier to slip when you're surrounded by it every single day. Those of you in work, from those of you who work in areas where there's a lot of that goes on, a lot of cussing and cursing and all that stuff, it's easy to get caught off guard. You get caught up in that. It's easy. It's bad. You know, we become desensitized to it. Maybe we're not as offended by it as we should be. How has that worked for you in the last year? Let's go on to verse 8 says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. He didn't bless a Sabbath day, which we hear the argument a lot. He blessed the Sabbath day, and that's why we're here to worship Him. And what more can we say about this? Look again, look around us, outside. What's going on out there? This is play day for a lot of people. This is a day they're going to do what they want to do. This is my day to do fun stuff. And it's not a holy day to them at all. Even folks that keep Sunday as their Sabbath have found a way to, if they go to church maybe Saturday evening, then they could still play on Sunday. See, and I don't fault them. They may not know any better. God hasn't called everyone yet. But we understand this. We're to keep it holy. It is not kept by the vast majority of the people in the world today. And how have we done? Have we let that slack a little bit in our lives? It's okay, we'll do it this one time. Or are we rigid when it comes to the Sabbath? You know, even on Sunday, people run out of church as fast as they can, or do what, you know, to make sure they have plenty of time to do what they want to do. God says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. It is holy time. How are you doing on that in the last year? Verse 12, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Our fifth commandment. And for fathers, I have this to say. In 2010, based upon statistics from the U.S. Census, 25.8% of the children were living in households with no adult male present. 26%. In 1990, it was less than 16%. So in 10 years, it's grown by 10%. 17.2% of children were living in neighborhoods where more than half of all families with children are female-headed. 30% of all men ages 25 to 34 earn less than the poverty level for a family of four. And in 2000, 39%, according to the census, 39% of the children were born to unmarried mothers, almost 40%. I live in Racine. 2010, 78% of the children were born to unwed mothers in Racine. I read an article. I found an article. It's entitled "Children at the Mercy of the Media. It was written by a lady named Judy Mann. And she works with the Kaiser Family Foundation, and they put it this way. They said, after dinner, these children are talking about children and media and how it's affected by them. It says, after dinner, these children retire to bedrooms that are their own media centers. More than half of all children have a radio, tape player, TV, CD player, etc. in their room. A third have video games. Almost a third have DVD players, and more than one in seven have their own computer. Among children 8 and under, 65% have televisions in their room, and 1 in 5 has a computer. A third of the children ages 2 to 7, one-third of them, have TVs in their bedrooms. And parents reported that these young children spend more than 4 hours an evening watching TV. Half of all the children say they have no rules about what they can watch on TV or how much they can watch. TV is a universal babysitter, the Kaiser Foundation says. 95% of the children over 7 years of age watch TV by themselves. Children's use of the media peaks from the age of 8 to 13. They spend 8 hours and 45 minutes of every day with some kind of media. More than one-fourth of the people spend more than 5 hours a day watching TV. More than one of the children, I should say. Television remains a dominant media force in children's lives, with over two-thirds reporting that they spend more than an hour a day watching TV, and 17% saying that they spend more than 5 hours a day watching TV. A decade ago, the National Assessment of Education Progress found that the top 10 states in math proficiency were also the states that reported the least time children spent watching television. It also found that the states where children watched the most television had the lowest overall math proficiency. The Kaiser study also found that children with A's and B's spent more time reading and less time with other media. The verdict, it says, could not be more clear about the impact of too much media on children's grades. It doesn't take a genius, it says here, to figure out which way families should be going when it comes to influencing their children's use of the media. The message from the study is clear. Take the TV out of the bedroom and put in a bookcase. Now, they haven't even addressed not only the fact of just sitting there watching things, they didn't even address what they're watching. Now, and that's a whole different story to talk about what they're being influenced by. Let's read verse 13. Verse 13, you shall not murder. Unless, that's not quite right though, in Hollywood and society, it's okay if you're rich and have a good lawyer, or so it seems to be. If you look back over the years, a lot of people that have murdered and gotten away with it. But just look at our prisons. They're full of murderers. You know, there are some states that have legalized euthanasia now. A gentleman by the name of Peter Singer, who is a professor of bioethics at Princeton University, and he wrote a book in 1985 that I came across here recently. It's a little old, but it's right to the point. It says, the book was titled, this is 1985, Should the Baby Live? And Singer suggests an arbitrary 28-day period after birth before an infant has full legal protection. Before then, parents, after consultation with doctors, could decide that disabled babies, even those with Down syndrome, which involves permanent mental retardation, quote-unquote, could be allowed to die or humanely killed. Do you know that this is being talked about again? Giving them a month after birth to decide if we're going to let them live or kill them. I heard that, and I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. That's what our society is like. That's what's around us. This Peter Singer is a professor at a very prestigious college, and he's teaching ethics classes to maybe your child. Verse 14. You shall not commit adultery. That's not important to people today. You know, they say, oh, don't be a prude. It's the way it is. You know people, and so do I. I have several employees living with the boy or the girlfriend, and they see nothing wrong with it. And they're having children. I have lots and lots of single mothers. And it's not even something that they're embarrassed about or ashamed about. That's not what God expects. That's not part of the way He expects us to live. What's your opinion on this? Have you softened over the years? Because it's going on around us so much, maybe you tolerate a little bit more? You don't think it's bad as it is? It's not for us, not just the fact that we're not committing adultery, but what's our thoughts about it? How do we feel? Where's our stance? What's going on up here about that? That's what's important to God as well. We are to separate ourselves completely from this world. Verse 15, you shall not steal. Read the paper, watch the news. Maybe at your own house, something has been stolen. It happens everywhere. Nothing is safe. Verse 16, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. I was recently talking with one of my managers about one of his staff who had lied about being sick and took the day off. It was a couple weeks ago. We had a really nice day, and he took the day. He said he called in sick, and he wasn't. And as we were discussing this, I'm giving him some direction that this is going to be treated seriously. We don't condone this. This is lying. This is cheating the company. It's not going to be condoned. And the manager says, oh, please, tell me you've never lied. First of all, I didn't appreciate the tone, you know, but obviously I would have been lying to tell him I had never lied, because unfortunately I have. You know, it's something that as a youngster I thought I was really good at, and every time I took a beating from my mother, it seemed I never learned. I wasn't as good at it as I thought I was. The point is that it's not a big deal to people anymore about lying, and it's almost expected. I'm telling him, you're going to discipline him. He's like, have you ever lied? Come on. Where are we? How do we feel about that? You know, it's around us. It's everywhere. Perjury, forgery, whatever. It's out that. What is your attitude towards this? Is it not a big deal? Verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. What about the old keeping up with the Joneses? Sorry. I'm trying to keep up with the Joneses, but I can't. He's way ahead of me. You know, we're bombarded every single day. You know, you look at all the advertisers. They're good at what they do. They are experts at making you think you need that or you want that. They're good at convincing us that what we have isn't enough, that we need more. And they keep at it, and they keep at it, until finally you're convinced, I do need that. Or at least I really want it. You know, my cell phone is outdated by a month now. They have a new version. You know, that's not cool. You know, ads are very alluring. They're very convincing. We can't have enough. That's unfortunately part of our human nature. But God tells us, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. Shall not covet. Always want more. How has that changed in your life since last Passover? your attitude towards this. Matthew 24, verse 12, we talked about this when we started as I wrap up this message. The Jewish New Testament version says this, "And many people's love will grow cold because of an increased distance from the Torah," or law. We can see it. The love of many is growing cold. It's going on all around us. And these things are God prophesies to us, and we can see it coming. Things are, and it's only going to increase in severity. And it's very easy for every single one of us to be affected by society when you're in it all the time, when you're forced to work in it and live in it. It's everywhere we turn. Verse 12, again, of Matthew 24. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. Will you endure to the end?